Now, the PolitiFact Wisconsin project has just passed a milestone. They've checked 1,000 claims in the last 5 years relating to statements made by politicians and other public figures.
Joining us to talk about how they do their research and what trends they've seen is James Nelson. He works for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as a reporter for PolitiFact Wisconsin and a deputy business editor. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, PolitiFact Wisconsin started about 5 years ago. What was the political landscape in Wisconsin like back then?
It was a lot different. Scott Walker was Milwaukee County Executive, and when we started, it was right before the Republican primary for governor, and that was one of the first elections that we covered as PolitiFact. The Democrats were in charge of the governor's mansion and the state legislature, and Paul Ryan was a member of Congress. And, of course, he's gone on, and Governor Walker has gone on, and others have gone on to take over the State House and advance their careers in a variety of ways.
So you've been, PolitiFact has been up and running during years of huge change in Wisconsin. How does that affect what you've been doing?
You know, when we did our roundup of looking back on our 1,000 items, we've realized that looking back, it was sort of a walk through history of all the tumult and so forth about the passage of Act 10 and the the campaign that the governor waged to running for president, and of course the recall campaign. But some of the same issues have come up again and again, and some of the same players. And for instance, job creation and a random sampling, the 10 items that I chose when we did our walk through the first 1,000 items, almost half of them were claims that were about job creation and claims on both sides, from both sides of the aisle, about job creation. And that really underscores how important economic issues are in this time.
How influential would you say PolitiFact Wisconsin has been? Have you, for instance, fact-checked something, reported it maybe to be false or sort of false, and seen a politician change course, re-message?
Sometimes. We also, last month on National Recycling Day, we had a little fun and went back and looked at some claims, including some from Governor Walker and some from others, who we'd rated a claim and in some cases rated it false or pants on fire, which is ridiculously false, and see the same claim be repeated again, sometimes by a different speaker or a different organization. But we've also seen since PolitiFact started, we've seen the language of fact checking factor into things like the presidential debate. I remember one of the debates between Governor Romney and President Obama, and Governor Romney again and again referred to this as a fact. And we often have press conferences or attend press conferences or replay them, and often the speaker will look up and say, "Go ahead, fact check me on that." So there, it's become part of the political process.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you say, there's been a rise of fact checking in media circles. So how is what, say, PolitiFact Wisconsin does different than the job, really, of the media, which is to make sure that the truth is being told and to hold people like elected officials accountable?
It's another way of holding politicians, pundits, and third-party groups accountable. Our method of reporting is no different than our method of reporting of in-depth or enterprise stories. Our processes are a little different. When we choose a statement to evaluate, the first phone call or email we shoot off is to the speaker of that statement. And the first thing we do is we ask them, where did that information come from? How do you substantiate the statement you've made? And then we go on from there. Another thing that we do differently than conventional news coverage is, especially with our online version, you can see our sources. You can see the reports we read, the interviews we conducted. We list all of our sources just like you would in the footnotes for a term paper. It's very rigorous, and that's something we're very proud of.
And we're going to dive in just a little. We're going to keep talking with you after another pledge break here, but PolitiFact Wisconsin just passed a big milestone, 1,000 facts checked in 5 years. It's a lot of facts. Well, let's take a look at some of the notable claims during that period. We'll start with this one. Claim 100 relates to State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. And by the way, we're going to get at fact-checking on both sides of the aisle, but tell us about Claim 100.
Well, that was when Senator Fitzgerald talked about photo ID. And he, in that instance, the claim that he made was that there were instances of people trying to vote five or six times a day. And we, like I said before, the first call we make is to the office of we try to reach the individual who made the claim. And in this case, the senator's office couldn't provide a single example of somebody who voted or tried to vote four, five, six times a day. And that was part of the debate that led to the passage of the voter ID law. But the statement that that he made, it was we rated that as false.
And we're going to get to more of those claims that you fact-checked over the years as we continue our conversation with James Nelson, who works for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as a reporter for PolitiFact Wisconsin, and he's also a deputy business editor.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation with James Nelson, who works on the PolitiFact Wisconsin project. They just checked their 1,000th claim. And Jim, let's take a look at another fact here, fact 200, if you would. This one relates to something that Governor Walker said. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a claim shortly after he was governor, when he was responding to the outcry of Act 10, and he pointed out that Milwaukee County was spending, where he was previously county executive, was spending more than $170,000 in salaries the previous year for employees to participate in union activities, such as collective bargaining. And that was that statement was true, because actually the county spent about $180,000 for three union presidents who did union work full time, and they spent it, the money went to other part time employees as well. That's really common for public employee union contracts, and that was something that had been negotiated between the county and the unions in question.
And, you know, when we look at the vast array of things people say, elected officials and all the other kinds of people, pundits, representative spokespeople, people say a lot of stuff. How do you decide what you're going to check?
You know, there's a couple of rules of thumb that my colleagues, Tom Kircher, Dave Umhafer, and our editor for PolitiFact, Greg Borowski, we use, it's kind of a rule of thumb that's boils down to one word, and that's the word really. And if we read something, we see something, somebody sends it in and says, hey, check this out, if we look at each other and say, really, is that the case, then we know it's a potential item. You know, we do a little vetting to make sure we haven't done it previously, we haven't you know, that it's difficult to fact check a statement of opinion, obviously, but that's sort of our rule of thumb. And also, when it comes time for the items to be ruled upon, the ruling, the decision of what the final ruling is true, mostly true, and so forth, and pants on fire, those decisions are made by editors who had nothing to do with the gathering of the story. They use what PolitiFact founder Bill Adair calls the kind of the, we call it the Mabel test. And it's, Mabel is a hypothetical reader sitting at her table in Stevens Point or Waupaca. And it's, if Mabel knew all the facts that were associated with that statement, what would Mabel say? And that's sort of the common sense approach that we try to take when the editors evaluate the statements.
I got to ask, how did you come up with the name Mabel?
That was a creation of Bill Adair, who created PolitiFact at the St. Petersburg Times Washington Bureau in 2007. PolitiFact is in 10 states, and Bill and now his successors running the national operation, when a news organization in a different state decides to participate in PolitiFact, they go through a training manual, several days of training. We all follow the same standards. We all follow the same common sense approach, show your work, make the call to the speaker first, and so on and so forth. And the Mabel thing is something Bill Adair cooked up, and frankly, it kind of works.
Now, going back to the word you said, you ask each other, really, is this true? I half thought you were going to say the word truthiness, which is that Stephen Colbert word, because you don't just rate things true or false. I mean, a fact, right. The definition of a fact is that it's true or false, really, but there's a spectrum here that you're working with. How do you deal with that gray area? I mean, you told us a little bit about that process, but do you think it is kind of hard to fact check, that there is some truth to the word truthiness?
There actually is, and we have six different ratings. Obviously, if the statement is true and there's nothing wrong with it and nothing significant missing, that's that. But we do mostly true, which is an accurate statement but needs clarification or additional information. Half true is if they've said part of a true statement, but they've left out, sort of the well but or the yeah but thing. If they've left out details or if they've taken things out of context. And then there's mostly false, which is an element of truth, but they ignore a critical fact that would give it a completely different impression. And then there's flat out false, which is a statement that's not accurate, and then there's pants on fire, which is an inaccurate statement and that makes a ridiculous claim. So,
do you know how many pants on fires you've given out in those 5 years?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. I would imagine that it's not the preponderance of our of the statements we've evaluated. I don't have a breakdown of. We didn't break it down that way. I will tell you that when candidates are running from behind, or they're lagging in the polls, or they're trying to stir up attention, or maybe if they're leading in the polls, you'll find them reaching for the truth, maybe, with the statements they make and statements we evaluate.
Well, Jim, thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate your interest.
That was James Nelson, who works for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as a reporter for PolitiFact Wisconsin. PolitiFact Wisconsin just evaluated claim number 1,000.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. For people brought up speaking English, it may seem like a perfectly natural language, but there are a lot of quirks that can make it difficult to learn.
There's the spelling. Think of the letters G-H together. They can sound like a hard G, like ghost, like an F, for some reason, like rough or enough, or be completely silent, like in through or bought.
Our next guest says it goes way beyond spelling, though. There are a lot of ways English is unique, especially among its European cousins, in part because of its unusual history through the centuries and England.
John McWhorter joins us now. He's a professor of linguistics at Columbia University, and his books include What Language Is and The Language Hoax. John, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure.
Well, when I saw the headline of your piece on how odd the English language is, I immediately thought of spelling. That's the obvious thing. But you write that it goes way deeper than that. So what are some of those other weird properties of English that we might not be aware of?
Yeah, a fish don't know they're wet, and so we just talk, and if anything, it's other languages that we see as odd. But as European languages go, in particular, English has a very odd history, and it is partly that we are speaking a language that is profoundly impacted by languages that most of us don't know much about, and that is Celtic languages. There were languages like Welsh that were spoken in England before the Anglo-Saxons came. And the way they spoke English reflected the way their languages worked, not in terms of words, but in terms of the grammar, in a really heavy way. And linguists have begun to realize, especially over about the past 15 years, that an awful lot of what seems like normal English to us would have seemed like very strange English to a speaker of Old English, because we're speaking English through Welsh. And then after that, when the Vikings invaded, not only did they invade and make people uncomfortable, but they spoke Old Norse, which was different from Old English, and they were adults. They were mostly men, and they would never have learned to speak Old English perfectly, but they married English-speaking women, and people grew up listening to one parent speaking basically bad English. But this is a time when there's barely a such thing as school. Most people are illiterate. There's no such thing as media. And so this funny way of speaking didn't just kind of get washed down the drain. It didn't become just a kind of a statistical flutter. It became something that was part of how you learned how to talk. So after a while, English became much more like the English I'm speaking now, which is a much easier language than Old English in many ways. Old English had grammar a lot like Latin. Modern English has grammar nothing like that. It has a lot fewer bells and whistles. And that's because of Vikings basically screwing the language up and passing it down to us so that we're speaking that now. And then finally, there was the what I call in the article a fire hose spray of words from French and Latin especially, such that we have so many words where we can say things in different ways that come from different languages. And so it's not that any language doesn't have different ways of saying the same thing. But in our case, it's often that, for example, you'll say help, and that's from English. You'll say aid, and that's from French. Then you'll say assist, and that's from Latin. And those stack in terms of formality, because French and Latin came in formal context, and Latin in especially formal context, because it was mostly through the printed page. So in terms of what English is like now versus what English was like 2,000 years ago, it has had quite a journey and experienced quite a lot of change, more so than most European languages have during that time.
Right. And when we look back at Old English, for all intents and purposes, for most of us, it might as well be a foreign language. Is that common for other languages where the older forms are so unrecognizable?
Not to that extent. And so, for example, a French person does not look at Latin and see a version of their own language, but it's quite clear that their language came from that language. Looking at what German itself looked like 1,500 years ago, it's certainly not the language of today, but it's recognizable and a German speaker can pick their way through it. Then there are extreme cases where, for various reasons, Icelandic has changed unusually little in its basics since it was Old Norse, so that Icelanders today can still read without too much trouble things that were written so very long ago. Whereas we look at Beowulf, and it's written in something that we can only academically recognize as the language we speak, because the vocabulary is so completely different, because the way the grammar works is so completely different. That's weird as Europe goes. Now, the truth is, and there's already been some blowback from the real professionals against my piece, it's arbitrary to say English is weird compared to the 7,000 languages of the world. And that's not what I meant. There's an extent to which when you write for the media, certain things are going to get somewhat oversimplified, especially in terms of what something is called. That's just natural. But in terms of languages in Europe, English is definitely a very interesting story.
We're talking about what makes English different and unusual with John McWhorter. And John, as an English speaker who's tried, and I'd say mostly failed, to learn European languages, one thing that seemed weird to me was, what, tables have a gender, dogs have a gender, mm-hmm. whether they're male or female dogs. There's these gendered changes, things in different languages that we don't have. Actually, we're the odd ones out, right?
Exactly. And so we try to learn other languages and we think, these languages have arbitrary gender. But really, the proper way to think of it is, our language doesn't. Because really, if you're part of the family of languages, the brood, that English is, you're really supposed to have arbitrary gender if you're one of the European ones. It's a group called Indo-European, and as you might be able to hear, there's a European bunch, and then there's the Indo bunch, which is spread out eastward of the homeland of this group that was probably in what's today Ukraine. And in the European group of those languages, English is the only one that doesn't have those arbitrary genders. Now, you do find some Indo-European languages that don't eastward, but it's just some. And the main point is that in Europe, that doesn't happen at all. So English is unusual, and that's because of the Vikings. The Vikings came along, and they had their own arbitrary genders in Old Norse, and the way they spoke English was just as we would expect with the way people learn languages today. They just chucked the arbitrary gender anyway because you don't need it to communicate. So here we are today. We don't use that in our language, and we see as exotic when we have to pick it up for Spanish or German or actually just about any European language other than Finnish and Estonian and a few others that aren't part of the Indo-European family. But really, we're odd. English is very queer in that way.
Another way we're unusual, we have no really close relatives, not to the extent that other languages do. Really, we don't have a sibling language?
Yeah, we don't have one in the way that, say, a German speaker does not really have to work all that hard to master basic Dutch, and they can actually glean a lot of Dutch conversation. English doesn't have that, unless you talk about other kinds of what most of us would think of as English. And so with Scots, if you're listening to true Scots, you can only be getting about half of the signal. But in terms of a language that is part of what is considered a separate nation with a completely separate history, we don't have that because of our bastard vocabulary. Most Germanic languages have mixture, but English is so mixed that we have a situation where if we learn, say, a Romance language, then a lot of the words are familiar to us that are high. And so the words for things like television or police or presentation, that's easy, but then we have trouble with the basic words. If we try to learn German, the basic words for things like bread and fish and milk are easy. But then once you get to the words for things like present, past, etc., it's harder. We end up missing those Romance words. That's because we're a mixture of the two things, which means that we can't listen to a language spoken in another country and think, there's what we are except different. The closest to it is a language called Frisian, which is spoken in some places in Northern Europe. And really, if we listen to Frisian, we can barely get a thing, because if Frisian is like anything, it's like German and Dutch, which is them and not us.
So our short, simple words, and as I understand it, a lot of our swear words probably came from the Angles and Saxons and maybe the Vikings, and you were alluding to this earlier, our highfalutin words would have come from the Normans invading England and then are importing Latin and maybe Greek.
Exactly. And so we have this bifurcation, which is neat. It's a very interesting story, but it means that we're lonelier in our way. I have always envied the fact that for most Europeans, there's some language, and probably several, that they can learn where they don't really have to step too far out of their comfort zone, Germanic languages or Slavic languages. But for us, there's no language like that. If we have to learn to speak something else, we have to really take a deep breath and drink some coffee, because we're unique among the languages that we're related to.
Another weird quirk, we raise a cow to eat beef, we raise a pig to eat pork, and that was maybe because, I think you wrote this, the Anglo-Saxon servants were killing cows to serve beef to their French overlords.
Yeah, and so that's why we have that weird little difference. You know, why don't we say we eat pig? And so we have these levels that come from different languages. And I always like to specify, it's not that a language that hasn't had all of that contact with other ones doesn't have levels in terms of how you use words to refer things. And even in English, in Old English, we are aware of four or five words that, as far as we know, meant understand. You know, there's one that means under grasp, et cetera, these variants on the theme. We can't know how those words were processed by an Old English speaker. Almost certainly, they had different shades of meaning, and one of them would have meant more like what we phrase as get it, whereas the other one would be more like what we phrase as to comprehend. So any language has these sorts of things, but it's the mongrel history of ours that makes English kind of fun if you think about these things, but also means that it's harder to learn other languages.
And you write that some people have made the argument because it's a mongrel language and has all these different influences and maybe shades of meaning, it's a richer language. You can do more with it. You don't buy that, though.
No, I don't know what the metric for that is. It's definitely true that a written language has a larger recorded vocabulary because you can preserve words in amber because of the printed page. So there's no doubt that if there's a language in the rainforest and you could actually record every single word known to all of its speakers, there wouldn't be as many as there are in English. But when you get to whether English or Russian is the richer language, even if you wave away the fact that it's very hard to determine what qualifies as a word when you're counting them, I am unaware of any really empirical study that would show that, say, English is richer than Spanish. And it certainly doesn't happen because of the mixture, because, again, it's absurd to think that somebody speaking Old English in 500 AD only had one way to say help. They had a way of indicating the difference between help out and help and give assistance, because we've never known any human language that didn't have distinctions of that kind. Nevertheless, the mixture does create an interesting history for our language and create the weirdness that I'm talking about. But English has spread around the world not because there was something flexible or flinty or even accepting about it. Russian or Inuktitut could just as easily have spread around the world. English spread around the world because the English, for better or for worse, were very good at colonizing and imposing their language. And so here we are today. It's tempting to think that the reason this language is spoken in so many places is because it doesn't have bristling paradigms of conjugation tables for its verbs, and it doesn't have arbitrary gender. But, you know, look at what Russian used to be, which was some obscure Slavic tongue spoken in one place in what is now Eastern Europe, and now has been imposed on speakers of several hundred languages, all of whom speak it as if they were in Moscow. And yet Russian is so hard that, at least from the English perspective, it can often seem almost unlearnable. Any language can take over the world. English happened to have a particularly potent colonial power behind it. But that doesn't mean English isn't still interesting in itself.
John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, sure.
That was John McCorder, linguistics professor at Columbia University. His piece on the English language is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.